Yes.
Perhaps it kind of goes back to what Daryl was saying about the posture. I wonder, and of course this is for both of you, what is the way to find the balance between trying to hold the right posture, which is upright, as Daryl mentioned, and on the other hand, not going too much, not verifying your posture too much, correcting it too often?
Are you talking about posture in the sitting position?
Yes.
What I teach my students is to sit in a way that's dignified. If you imagine, this might not be so good being so close to Quebec, but if you imagine Queen Elizabeth was just having a tour of this center, and she was going to come in and see us all, we'd say, okay, sit in your most dignified posture. There's a certain sense of presence, but it's not too stiff. And most people, when they say, okay, I'm going to sit in a dignified way, that usually is the posture. Now, you may be saying, what happens if the posture shifts? Because what happens after a period of sitting is sometimes, although we start off dignified, we start to lean forward. If you're past a certain point, so let's say your neck is down, that's not wise to stay there. So if you notice that, then just mindfully bring yourself back to that dignified posture and then continue your practice, rather than staying in a position that probably isn't very comfortable. Does that help? Okay. Anyone else? All righty. I'm going to ask you to close your eyes for a few moments. And I'd like you to reflect on what your purpose was in coming to this retreat. What did I hope to accomplish or get from participating in this retreat? For some of you, there was maybe no agenda. But my guess is for others of you, you might want it to feel calmer or less anxious. There may have been a desire to resolve some work or relationship difficulty. Perhaps to learn how to cope with stress or physical pain more effectively. Just be clear about what your purpose was in coming here. And then opening your eyes again. Now, I might suggest that the list of things I read out are actually the side effects of the practice, not the goal. The goal of this practice is to see the truth of life, because as Jesus and many other sages have said, seeing the truth of life sets you free. So what does it mean when I talk about freedom? I want to focus on two kinds of freedom: psychological freedom and spiritual freedom. Psychological freedom means freedom from a sense of self that is somehow inadequate or not enough. Not smart enough, not competent enough, not lovable enough, not intelligent enough. Some aspect of who I am is somehow deficient. And these beliefs about ourself, which form our self-concept, are the result of conditioning in our early childhood, primarily as a result of how we're treated by our parents. Now, I don't want to be judging our parents. They are doing the best job they could, but often they might have been very critical and judgmental, with the belief that if I'm challenging my child, they'll kind of work harder and be better. Or perhaps there was some kind of dysfunction in the family, alcohol or drugs. And so if one of your parents was involved, for example, in alcohol, they're not fully there for you. If they are there, often as a consequence of the changes that occur with alcohol, they could be physically, emotionally, or sexually abusive. Children perceive the world differently than adults do. The style of perception of a child is called egocentric, and it shifts from the child style to the adult style somewhere around 12 to 14 years of age. So I'll give you the difference. If I'm 18, so I'm looking at the world from the adult perspective, and my mom and dad fight and get a divorce, the 18-year-old says, that's their problem, it's got nothing to do with me. But an 8-year-old in that same circumstance will say, if only I was a better little boy, mommy and daddy wouldn't fight. Nothing could be further from the truth, but the child perceives everything that's going on as being about them. That starts to form our self-concept, who we are. And even when we grow beyond the age of 12 to 14, when we start to see the world from this adult perspective, these beliefs about what is not okay with us are still there. So although these beliefs are definitely impacted by our spiritual practice, from my perspective, this is primarily the focus of psychotherapy. So what do I mean by spiritual or ultimate freedom? This means freedom from all our self-identifications, all the things that we identify with. We identify with our bodies, our minds, our thoughts, our emotions, our gender, our roles, our work. I'll give you some examples. And why this really doesn't work. We often identify as, I am my body. Well, what happens if you had an accident and you had a leg amputated? Is there any less of you? There's less of the body, but I don't think you'd say there's less of you. So then, am I really the body? What about my mind? I'm my mind. That's a common misperception. When I do my initial interviews with people coming for the mindfulness-based stress reduction program, at one point in the interview, I say to them that you and the mind are not the same thing. And people get this puzzled look and they say, what do you mean I'm not my mind? I say, well, if you are your mind, you should have some control over what it does. And the exercise I give them, because remember, nothing is to be believed. This is all to go out and investigate yourself and trust your experiences. I said, the next time you have one of those songs that plays again and again in your head, when you get sick of hearing it, if you are the mind, you should be able to say, stop playing that song, and you should just get it to stop. And people discover, well, I can't get it to stop. Well, then, am I really my mind if I really don't have much control over it? What about our emotions? We identify with our emotions quite readily. I'm angry. I'm sad. I'm in love, as if that's who I am. But of course, our emotions are constantly changing. We identify with our gender. That's a strong one for many people. What gender is your breath? Is it male or female? What gender is your mind? You realize that's not who you are. We identify with our roles. You know, I'm a father or I'm a husband. But what happens if my relationship breaks up and I'm strongly identified with being a husband? Who am I then? Or what happens if I lose a child? Recently, I saw a father who I think their child had been abducted and died and was just grieving tremendously. There was such suffering. And the father was saying, she was my life. He didn't have a sense of himself outside of being the father, from what I could tell from the interview on the television. We identify with our work. I'm a teacher. Well, what happens if I can't teach anymore? Who am I then? These are some of the ways we identify with aspects of our body. And these identifications result as a consequence of a significant perceptual distortion. What is this distortion? That there is an unchanging entity, which we refer to as myself, that is separate from the rest of life, that resides in a body, that endures over time, that experiences emotions, that makes decisions about what we do, and that is in control more or less of our life. That's a significant distortion of our perception. And it's pretty much, without anyone who's really looked, that's the common perception of how we see ourselves. Einstein referred to this perceptual distortion as an optical delusion of our consciousness. I really like that. In his book, A Path with Heart, Jack Kornfield states that there are two parallel paths in spiritual life. One is to discover selflessness. The other is to develop a healthy sense of self. Both sides of this apparent paradox must be fulfilled for us to awaken. That's our challenge, to have a sense of self that is acceptable to us and also realize selflessness. Daryl and I share the same teacher, Matthew Flickstein, and he often states that psychotherapy is about discovering who you are, and spiritual practice is discovering who you are not, but thought yourself to be, seeing through all these identifications to discover what's left when you've done that. So recognizing selflessness and the freedom that arises as a consequence of this realization is the goal of our spiritual practice. Now, what is meant by selflessness? Because it's a word you're going to hear, and it's often misunderstood. It does not mean that there is no self. Self and no self are two sides of a duality. Selflessness, or you might say not self, is the middle way that transcends the duality of self and no self to point to the actual truth of our experience. In his teachings, the Buddha invites us to carefully investigate this psychophysical organism we refer to as ourself to really discover its true nature. And when we mindfully investigate what we refer to as ourself, we discover that what we thought was an enduring, unchanging entity is actually a dynamic, flowing, changing body-mind process. To be able to see this, however, requires that we have accurate perception. Perception, as most people see things, is actually from a distance and they don't see very clearly. I was going to say, when I prepared for this, that if you look across the river, and then I came in here and realized you can't really see very much across the river because of that tree, but if you could, you'd probably see all green on the other side. That's perception from a distance. If you moved closer or you had a magnifying device like binoculars, you might start to see individual trees. If you look closer, you might see the branches and the leaves. As you moved really close, you might move into the molecular level, and what you would see is actually a lot of space with some subatomic particles wandering around. We'd be looking at the same thing, but we'd be looking more closely to see the true nature. So perception with mindfulness allows mindfulness to put a frame around the experience so then we can look more closely to see the truth of what's happening, to what the truth of what we're observing. There are several ways the Buddha divided this psychophysical organism, but the one is most frequently referred to as the five aggregates. Daryl mentioned that this morning, or more appropriately, I think, called the five aggregates of clinging. As we mistakenly cling or identify with one or more of these aggregates as being who we are when we don't see clearly the truth of our experience. Now, the word aggregate is not commonly used in the English language. Well, actually, where I live, I see the word a lot, because in Muskoka, there's lots of quarries. And quarries sell aggregates, okay? Aggregates are, you know, different kinds of crushed stone. So that's not what we're talking about. But the word, in this case, refers to the five kinds of collections of stuff that make up a human being. So what are these five aggregates that I've been referring to? First, there is the aggregate of physical form and its five senses. That one's pretty easy to attend to. Second, the second through the fifth aggregate are not about the physical body and sensations. These are all aspects of the mind. So the second of the aggregates is feeling. And feeling in this case means the quality of sense experience as being either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Where every moment of our life we're having a sensory experience, a sight, a sound, a smell, a touch, and in each time we have one of these sensory experiences, we'll observe that it's either pleasant, it's unpleasant, or neutral. Why that's important is that the mind relates to these different feelings. When something is pleasant, the mind really wants to hold on to it. When something is unpleasant, the mind wants to push it away. And when it's neutral, that's when we space out and tend to go on automatic pilot. So that's why feelings are so important to be aware of. The third aggregate is the aggregate of perception, and Daryl touched on this morning in her talk. The fourth aggregate is the aggregate of mental formations, which refer to the emotional, intellectual, and volitional aspects of the mind. And the fifth aggregate is consciousness, or the knowing quality of the mind. Each one of these aggregates is constantly changing and flowing. Our sensations in the body are constantly changing. The feelings of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral are constantly changing. Our perceptions are changing. Our thoughts and emotions are changing. And actually, consciousness is changing. It's changing to have a moment of sight consciousness, sound consciousness, hearing consciousness. So all of these aggregates individually are constantly changing. When these five different components of the psychophysical organism come together or are combined, we refer to it as a human being. Similarly, if you had four tires, an engine, a transmission, a body, and an interior, you'd have a car. No one element by itself is the car, but you put these elements together, you have a car. No one aggregate by itself is a human being. But if you put these five aggregates together, that's what we refer to as a human being. Is everyone clear about what I'm talking about with the five aggregates? Is there anything that isn't clear about this? So there's the physical, the body element with its five senses, and then there's feeling, perception, mental formation, emotions, thoughts, volitions, and consciousness that's aware of what's unfolding. Those are the five aggregates. So, seemingly it's making sense. Okay. The Buddha stated there are four ways that untrained people create a sense of self with respect to the aggregates. First, there is the belief that I am one of the aggregates. I am the body, I am my thoughts or emotions, or I am consciousness. That's a pretty common one. Secondly, people believe that they are within one of the aggregates, that there is a self, for example, perhaps in the brain, controlling what is arising. Alan Watts has a wonderful image for this. He said, it's just like we all have some sense that there's a little person somewhere behind our eyes who is sitting in front of a big screen so you can see what's going on outside. They're wearing headphones so they can hear what's going on. They have some other sensors so they can tune in to taste and smell. And they're operating controls that move it around, and it's all encapsulated in what he calls a bag of skin. That's not an unusual perception of who we are, in my experience. So that's the second way we identify with one of the aggregates. Thirdly, we might believe that we are outside of one of the aggregates, but controlling what they do, like a soul, for example. And then fourth, they believe that they are one with everything. But in this case, there's still a belief in a separate self that's separate from the rest of life. I am one with everything. There's still separation. Now, before we sit, I want to review the three aspects of insight meditation. It's kind of somewhat reviewing what Daryl mentioned earlier, because some of you are very new to this practice, and I think review is probably useful at this stage of the game. So, insight meditation has three components. First of all, there's momentary concentration, as a contrast to absorption concentration. Last night when we sat down and we just focused on the breath, one object, we were trying to absorb our awareness into that object. So that's absorption concentration. It's useful for stilling and calming the mind, but it's not so practical for daily life because we're not always going around looking at one thing. What's happening is life is happening here and there and there. There's sights and sounds and smells. We want to have a mind that can stay concentrated but focus on the variety of changing moment-to-moment experiences. So that's momentary concentration. The second element is bare attention. Now, it's a quality of attention that's bare of three things. It's bare of judgment, it's bare of decision, it's bare of commentary. It's bare of judgment. Why is that important? If the mind judges something to be good or right or positive, what it will tend to do is try and hold on to that, and therefore we can't see its true nature. If the mind judges something to be wrong, unskillful, bad, there's a tendency of the mind to want to push it away, and we can't see its true nature. So this quality of attention is bare of judgment. It's not judging what we're observing moment to moment. It's also bare of decision. We're not sitting to make decisions about our life. What should I do about my work situation or this relationship or maybe some financial challenge? We're not reviewing conversations that we've had in the past or planning conversations in the future. We're not doing self-psychotherapy on ourselves. A lot of people, when they're sitting, are not actually doing insight practice. They're sitting trying to do self-psychotherapy. So it's bare of judgment, bare of decision, and it's bare of commentary. Now, the reality is, if you hadn't noticed, the mind has a comment about everything. So comments will be arising. But for each one of these things, the judgments, the decisions, and commentary, if that arises, rather than get lost in it, that just becomes an object of meditation and you're back into practice again. You start noticing the mind going, well, I shouldn't be thinking that. And then you're just aware of the judgment. Now you're not lost in it or believing it. Your practice is back on track. So it's bare of judgment, decision, and commentary. And the third quality or aspect of insight meditation is clear comprehension. Clear comprehension means seeing clearly in every moment of our experience, either that things are impermanent, that they're constantly changing, that they're unsatisfactory, that nothing, of course, is going to stay the same. So even if you're having a great experience, it's not totally satisfying because everything's impermanent, it's going to change. And then the third thing is selflessness, seeing that there is no enduring entity called a self. If you look at these three, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and selflessness, they're actually the same thing. It's just different ways of tuning into that. So these are the three aspects of insight meditation: that momentary concentration, bare attention, it's attention bare of judgment, decision, or commentary, and three, clear comprehension. At any moment, seeing clearly either that everything is changing, that things are unsatisfactory, or seeing for yourself the truth of selflessness. Any questions about that before we sit? Yes?
Do you mean that selflessness is like impermanence and that you kind of fall in between self-identification and out of self-identification?
Well, selflessness, and this means that there is no something called a self that endures. There is a changing process, but there's no self that's constant and unchanging anywhere in the process. Yeah. That's what we're trying to really investigate so that we are convinced by our experience. But we might see that there's identification and then there's moving back into selflessness. Until full realization, when we truly get this and live from that place, there may be moments where we're experiencing selflessness and then there's moments where we're once again identified. This is who I am. Okay? All right. So get in your sitting position. Again, sitting in a dignified posture. Closing your eyes. And starting to come into the body with awareness. Perhaps feeling the contacts of the buttocks on the chair, or your bench or your zafu. If you're sitting on a chair, perhaps the feet on the floor. Getting a sense of the body's energy as a whole. Does the body feel soft and relaxed right now? Are there areas of tension that I'm aware of in the body where there's holding? And see if you can let the eyes and the face be soft. Checking the shoulders if they're tightened up. See if you can soften the shoulders. Softening the chest and softening the belly. And now bringing your attention to the sensations of the breath, wherever you feel the breath most readily. For some of you, it will be at the nostril, for others, the chest, for others, the belly. And just holding the sensations of the breath as the sole focus of your awareness, feeling each in-breath and each out-breath as clearly and distinctly as you can. Observing the rhythm of the breath without trying to control or manipulate it in any way. But if the breath is deep, feel that it's a deep breath. And if the breath is shallow, be aware that it's a shallow breath. No need to make a shallow breath deeper or a deeper breath more shallow. Just let the breath breathe itself. Your job is just to be there with awareness, moment to moment, breath to breath, feeling the unfolding sensations. Noticing that sometimes the breath is long and sometimes the breath is short. Sometimes the breath is rapid and sometimes it's slow. Just letting the awareness connect moment to moment with the sensation of each breath. If we allow our awareness to move closer to the breath, we might start to notice that there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to each in-breath. And observing that there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to each out-breath. Observing that there's a brief pause at the end of the out-breath before the next in-breath begins. And noticing that there's a pause at the end of the out-breath before the next in-breath begins. Fully present with each aspect of the breath, all of the in-breath, the pause, all of the out-breath, and the pause. If you notice that the mind has wandered off, just gently but firmly bring the attention back once again to this breath, to this moment, and once again, just be fully here. Now, as you sit here, you may become aware of sensations arising in the body. If one of those sensations becomes strong enough to pull the attention away from the breath, then let go of the breath and make that sensation the object of your awareness, observing where it arises in your body. Does it stay in one place or does it move around? Is the intensity or the quality of the sensation changing? When it is clear to you that whatever you're focusing on is changing, it's not constant, then come back to the breath. Stay with the breath until the next sensation pulls your attention. Then make that the meditation's object. Going into it with awareness, feeling it fully, and when you notice that it's changing, coming back to the breath. Not resisting any sensations, not becoming attached to any sensations. Just observing the changing nature of the body moment to moment as you sit here. Now you may notice that thoughts and emotions may be arising. So if a thought or emotion arises and pulls your attention, then make that the object of your awareness. If it's an emotion, observe where you experience the emotion in the body. Noticing that you might feel anger has a very different experience than sadness or fear. There may be words that go with the emotion. He shouldn't have done that. What's going to happen in the future? So be aware of the storyline that may go with the emotion. Once it's clear to you that the emotion is also something not constant, but it's a changing experience, either the sensations in the body change or the storyline changes, come back to the breath. If the attention is pulled to thinking, then make the thought the object of your awareness. When you bring full awareness to thinking, for the most part, the thought will quickly dissolve, and you come back to the breath. So now opening up to the full experience of the body-mind, the breath, all the sensations in the body, thoughts and emotions. Notice if there are thoughts and emotions that you would choose not to have or think arising. Notice that you never know what your next thought will be. Truly see for yourself if you have any control over what thoughts and emotions arise as you just sit here and pay attention. So for some of you now, there'll be the small group conferences. Those of you who are meeting with me will be down the end of the corridor in the library. Those of you who are meeting with Daryl will be upstairs in the chapel. For the rest of you, it's a period of walking meditation.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.